The listening paper consists of three parts. You will hear recordings once only. In each part, there will be time for you to look at the questions before you hear the recordings. You can write your answers on the test booklet. At the end of the test, you will need to copy your answers to the answer sheet. Now, turn to part 1. You will hear a radio program. For questions 1 to 10, choose the best answer. A, B or C. Now you have 1 minute to look at the questions.
Hello and thank you for downloading Witness from the BBC World Service with me, Alan Johnston. And almost 30 years ago, the Coca-Cola Company carried out what is now seen as one of the biggest marketing blunders ever. In the summer of 1985, the company decided to change the secret recipe for its famous fizzy drink, despite its vast global popularity. This program was first broadcast in 2011. This sugary drink had become the single most widely distributed commercial product on Earth and the world's best-known brand name. But by the mid-80s, behind the scenes, the company had reason to be worried.
By the early 80s, Coca-Cola had been losing market share to Pepsi for 20 years.
Mark Pendergrast is a native of Atlanta, Georgia, the city that's home to Coke's global headquarters. Mark's father made display racks for Coca-Cola, and the company and its product were a permanent presence in his childhood. Much later, he spent years researching and writing his book called For God, Country and Coca-Cola. He's well placed to know why the firm's bosses were so concerned back in 1985.
They had tried pretty much everything that they could think of. Brilliant marketing, almost universal distribution. You also have to realize the CEO was a Cuban immigrant named Roberto Gazueta, who was very aggressive and who had declared that there was no sacred cow in the company, that he was willing to fiddle with any formula in order to dominate Pepsi. And there under his nose was a formula which was sacred and not to be touched, but which was losing gradually to Pepsi. For a company with the incredible pride and history of Coca-Cola, that was just intolerable. So Gazueta authorized secretly for them to begin playing with the formula, and they came up with one that was much more similar to Pepsi. It was sweeter, didn't have as much fizz or bite to it, and that did beat Pepsi in blind taste tests.
The new Coke, as it was called, hit the streets with all the hype and hoopla that you might expect. The first cans of this very American drink were given symbolically to workers who were renovating the Statue of Liberty. And along with the event in New York, down in Atlanta, there were giant US flags, marching bands, and majorettes went striding through the city. And at a press conference, Coke's executives came to explain what they were doing and why.
We discovered something else, a new cola formula, a product which our flavor scientists quickly realized was highly preferred by in-house expert taste panels over Coca-Cola itself and, of course, over its primary competition.
The whole story is going to be when that consumer in Atlanta and any place around the world puts their lips to this product, they're just flat going to enjoy it.
Coke's great rival, Pepsi, immediately declared victory as the world and the BBC looked on.
So thrilled are Pepsi by Coke's decision to change that in the United States they're running a special advertisement. It reads, "After 87 years of going at it eyeball to eyeball, the other guy just blinked." Coke, on the other hand, are still claiming that they're the real thing.
But to many loyal Coke drinkers, the new flavour just wasn't the real thing. The old Coke that they'd grown up with had suddenly been replaced with something different, and they were outraged. Their anger mounted until eventually the company was taking 8,000 calls a day from angry customers. A Coke fanatic in Seattle launched Old Cola Drinkers of America, an association that drew much attention as it campaigned against the new stuff. Comedians on television and columnists in the newspapers mocked and savaged the decision to switch. And the Cuban leader, Fidel Castro, suggested that the turmoil engulfing this iconic American product was symptomatic of a wider national malaise. But for Coke, perhaps the low point came when sports fans at the Houston Astrodome jeered its adverts on the stadium's giant screen.
The news during the spring and summer of 1985 was dominated by a collective national nervous breakdown over the change of the formula for a drink that is 99% sugar water. I mean, how important is this? It's not. And yet, it was.
How do you account for that kind of mentality? What was going on here?
Coca-Cola had become embedded in the American consciousness. So for better or worse, Coca-Cola had become a part of the American psyche and a symbol of the American way of life. Many people had their earliest memories, their first loves, their first dates associated with drinking Coca-Cola. Many parts of traditional life were being assaulted by the middle of the 1980s. And here was something that people thought was fundamental and firm and wasn't going to change, and it was changing, and they were appalled.
And eventually, Coke climbed down. How did it go about making that U-turn?
It was hard because they really had been sure that this was a good move, and they expected a little bit of resistance, but they had a superior drink, and they expected that in the long run it would do well. And they thought, you know, the media uproar over it, you know, would go away. But it did not go away. And you had protesters who were leading protests every day and getting a lot of coverage. People were pouring New Coke very publicly down sewer drains. It was a disaster. And it went on and on and on. So finally, in July, the company capitulated. They didn't say they were taking away New Coke. They weren't. But they brought back the old formula. What could they call it, though? They couldn't call it Coca-Cola, so they called it Coca-Cola Classic.
The U-turn was greeted as huge news. The ABC television network broke into its scheduled broadcasting to report the decision, and it made the front pages of almost every American newspaper. Speaking on the floor of the U.S. Senate, a congressman actually described the return of Old Coke as a meaningful moment in the nation's history.
But what's important is what the public did and what the market did. And what happened was Coca-Cola had had a place in America's heart all along, but not necessarily in its refrigerator. Now, with the reminder of what this drink meant to them, the market share for Coca-Cola began to go up, and it began to dominate Pepsi. And eventually, New Coke dwindled away to nothing. Coca-Cola Classic became, more than ever, the leading soft drink in America, so much so that many people thought that the whole thing had been a marketing ruse, that Coca-Cola had intended this whole thing in the first place, that it was a brilliant marketing hoax. And I can tell you for absolutely certain that that is not true. They screwed up, but it all turned out for the best for them.
But you can understand the conspiracy theorists, can't you? They're seeing this extraordinarily savvy company getting it so badly wrong and yet so magically coming out on the right side of this. You can understand, as I say, the skepticism.
I do understand it, and Americans love conspiracy theories, so of course they were going to say that, but it's not true.
That's all from this edition of Witness with me, Alan Johnston.
This is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear an extract from an audiobook. For questions 11 to 20, choose the best answer, A, B, or C. Now you have 1 minute to look at the questions.
The horizon was tinged with red, and suddenly the sun appeared. The boy thought back to that conversation with his father and felt happy. He had already seen many castles and met many women, but none the equal of the one who awaited him several days hence. He owned a jacket, a book that he could trade for another, and a flock of sheep, but most important, he was able every day to live out his dream. If he were to tire of the Andalusian fields, he could sell his sheep and go to sea. By the time he had had enough of the sea, he would already have known other cities, other women, and other chances to be happy. I couldn't have found God in the seminary, he thought, as he looked at the sunrise. Whenever he could, he sought out a new road to travel. He had never been to that ruined church before, in spite of having traveled through those parts many times. The world was huge and inexhaustible. He had only to allow his sheep to set the route for a while, and he would discover other interesting things. The problem is that they don't even realize that they're walking a new road every day. They don't see that the fields are new and the seasons change. All they think about is food and water. Maybe we're all that way, the boy mused, even me. I haven't thought of other women since I met the merchant's daughter. Looking at the sun, he calculated that he would reach Tarifa before midday. There, he could exchange his book for a thicker one, fill his wine bottle, shave, and have a haircut. He had to prepare himself for his meeting with the girl, and he didn't want to think about the possibility that some other shepherd with a larger flock of sheep had arrived there before him and asked for her hand. It's the possibility of having a dream come true that makes life interesting, he thought, as he looked again at the position of the sun and hurried his pace. He had suddenly remembered that, in Tarifa, there was an old woman who interpreted dreams. The old woman led the boy to a room at the back of her house. It was separated from her living room by a curtain of coloured beads. The room's furnishings consisted of a table, an image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and two chairs. The woman sat down and told him to be seated as well. Then she took both of his hands in hers and began quietly to pray. It sounded like a gypsy prayer. The boy had already had experience on the road with gypsies. They also travelled, but they had no flocks of sheep. People said that gypsies spent their lives tricking others. It was also said that they had a pact with the devil and that they kidnapped children, and taking them away to their mysterious camps made them their slaves. As a child, the boy had always been frightened to death that he would be captured by gypsies, and this childhood fear returned when the old woman took his hands in hers. But she has the Sacred Heart of Jesus there, he thought, trying to reassure himself. He didn't want his hand to begin trembling, showing the old woman that he was fearful. He recited an Our Father silently. Very interesting, said the woman, never taking her eyes from the boy's hands. And then she fell silent. The boy was becoming nervous. His hands began to tremble, and the woman sensed it. He quickly pulled his hands away. I didn't come here to have you read my palm, he said, already regretting having come. He thought for a moment that it would be better to pay her fee and leave without learning a thing, that he was giving too much importance to his recurrent dream. You came so you could learn about your dreams, said the old woman, and dreams are the language of God. When he speaks in our language, I can interpret what he has said, but if he speaks in the language of the soul, it is only you who can understand. But whichever it is, I'm going to charge you for the consultation. Another trick, the boy thought. But he decided to take a chance. A shepherd always takes his chances with wolves and with drought, and that's what makes a shepherd's life exciting. I've had the same dream twice, he said. I dreamed that I was in a field with my sheep, when a child appeared and began to play with the animals. I don't like people to do that because the sheep are afraid of strangers. But children always seem to be able to play with them without frightening them. I don't know why. I don't know how animals know the age of human beings. Tell me more about your dream, said the woman. I have to get back to my cooking, and since you don't have much money, I can't give you a lot of time. Well, the child went on playing with my sheep for quite a while, continued the boy, a bit upset. And suddenly, the child took me by both hands and transported me to the Egyptian pyramids. He paused for a moment to see if the woman knew what the Egyptian pyramids were, but she said nothing. Then, at the Egyptian pyramids, he said the last three words slowly, so that the old woman would understand. The child said to me, If you come here, you will find a hidden treasure. And just as she was about to show me the exact location, I woke up, both times. The woman was silent for some time. Then she again took his hands and studied them carefully. I'm not going to charge you anything now, she said. But I want one-tenth of the treasure, if you find it. The boy laughed out of happiness. He was going to be able to save the little money he had because of a dream about hidden treasure. Well, interpret the dream, he said. First, swear to me. Swear you will give me one-tenth of your treasure in exchange for what I am going to tell you. The shepherd swore that he would. The old woman asked him to swear again while looking at the image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. It's a dream in the language of the world, she said. I can interpret it, but the interpretation is very difficult. That's why I feel that I deserve a part of what you find. And this is my interpretation. You must go to the pyramids in Egypt. I have never heard of them, but if it was a child who showed them to you, they exist. There you will find a treasure that will make you a rich man. The boy was surprised and then irritated. He didn't need to seek out the old woman for this. But then he remembered that he wasn't going to have to pay anything. I didn't need to waste my time just for this, he said. I told you that your dream was a difficult one. It's the simple things in life that are the most extraordinary. Only wise men are able to understand them. And since I am not wise, I have had to learn other arts, such as the reading of palms. Well, how am I going to get to Egypt? I only interpret dreams. I don't know how to turn them into reality. That's why I have to live off what my daughters provide me with. And what if I never get to Egypt? Then I don't get paid. It wouldn't be the first time. And the woman told the boy to leave, saying she'd already wasted too much time with him. So the boy was disappointed. He decided he would never again believe in dreams. He remembered that he had a number of things he had to take care of. He went to the market for something to eat. He traded his book for one that was thicker, and he found a bench in the plaza where he could sample the new wine he had bought. The day was hot, and the wine was refreshing. The sheep were at the gates of the city in a stable that belonged to a friend. The boy knew a lot of people in the city. That was what made travelling appeal to him. He always made new friends, and he didn't need to spend all of his time with them. When someone sees the same people every day, as had happened with him in the seminary, they wind up becoming a part of that person's life, and then they want the person to change. If someone isn't what others want them to be, the others become angry. Everyone seems to have a clear idea of how other people should lead their lives, but none about his or her own. He decided to wait until the sun had sunk a bit lower in the sky before following his flock back through the fields. 3 days from now, he would be with the merchant's daughter.
This is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear part of a lecture. For questions 21 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B or C. Now, you have 1 minute to look at the questions.
Let me ask you a fascinating and rather strange question. What is the sound of a civilization as it collapses? What sound does an empire make when it comes crashing down? Imagine that we are standing on the ramparts of an ancient imperial city. It's a spring day in the year of 1453, and below us are uncountable, shouting, surging crowds of enemy soldiers who are massing for an attack on our city. High above those frenzied masses, we're standing on great thick walls that are already 1,000 years old. Until now, the walls have always held, repelling siege after siege, attack after attack. But shortly, we'll hear a new sound, louder and more frightening than any we have heard before. The booming thunder of siege cannon, beginning to pound, shatter, and then breach these great walls. That rumble of great cannon we hear in the distance announces the true end of the Roman Empire. Now, many educated people think they know about the fall of the Roman Empire, long ago at the start of the medieval period. They believe that the glory that was Rome collapsed when in 410 the Visigoths sacked Rome, or in 455 when the Vandals sacked Rome again, or when finally in 476 Germanic tribes slouched into the imperial capital in Italy and simply deposed the last Roman emperor in the West. Those bare facts are true, but the real story is much more complicated and actually comes much later. The real end of the Roman Empire as a whole actually happened 1,000 years later, at the dawn of our modern age, with the fall of the great imperial city of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks. Today, this is the city of Istanbul in Turkey, and in 1453, it was the focus of a dramatic turning point. Part of our difficulty in recognizing that this was the true fall of the Roman Empire is that later historians imposed a name on the surviving Roman Empire in the East that was not used by those people themselves. Historians called it Byzantium and referred to the Byzantine Empire. The name comes from an older Greek name for the settlement that had stood on that spot before. But in fact, the so-called Byzantines at their time called themselves Romans. Long after the Roman Empire in the West had fallen, the survivors in the great Roman Empire in the East thought of themselves as the true remaining Romans, even though they mostly spoke Greek. They saw their state as, self-evidently, the real Roman Empire. Constantinople had been established in the year 330 by Emperor Constantine, not far from where legendary Troy had once stood. Constantinople was to be the Roman capital of the East, and so it remained. It was set on a crucial, pivotal geopolitical spot, the meeting place of two oceans and two continents. This one spot straddles Europe and Asia, and the Turkish Straits, also called the Dardanelles and Bosphorus, link the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. These were key places in the horizons of the ancient classical world. Whoever ruled this city seemed to bestride much of the known world. But all this came crashing down in 1453, as the last remnants of the Roman Empire in the East crumbled and fell. Why did the fall of Constantinople matter? In what sense is this a turning point of modern history? The reasons are threefold. First, the end of the Roman Empire, the glory that had been Rome, would continue to haunt modern consciousness and echoes into our own times. Our very word empire, from the Latin word imperium, means authority, the ability to command. As we already suggested in our previous lecture, this theme of authority and how it changes will be a recurring theme in our course. The seemingly universal empire of Rome had been, in its day, a key source of political and symbolic authority. When it was gone, what would now replace it? Second, the fall of Constantinople would prompt repeated desperate bids to inherit the mantle of universal empire, reaching into modern times. It would be an abiding dream of men of destiny to revive the glory that had been Rome. Third and finally, the collapse of this Christian empire in the East redrew the world's political map in really fundamental ways and touched off, as a result, the European voyages of discovery that would lead Columbus to what for Europeans was a new world. So what did this glorious capital look like as the turning point of 1453 approached? An essential fact to keep in mind is that by 1453, once great Constantinople was in very bad shape. Centuries before, it had flourished. Imagine for a moment what its streets and market squares had been like when it was at its height. Here, where trade routes crossed, you could hear a multitude of languages of Europe and Asia. Walking in the alleyways, you could smell exotic spices imported from far away, wine of the very choicest vintages. Throughout the city were splendid churches with dark interiors glowing with gold and rich icons and crosses, and you could hear the chanting of monks and smell the wafting of incense. The imperial palaces radiated power. They were, in a way, dreams of marble and gold and silk in the imperial purple color. But all that was before. By 1453, this picture was much reduced and much poorer. The last two centuries had not been kind to Constantinople. In a terrible irony, in 1204, a Christian crusader army had actually sacked Constantinople. Fellow Christians devastating a Christian city. The Venetians, whose navy had brought the Crusaders on this mission, engaged in a massive pillaging of relics and art from Constantinople. Today, many tourists in Venice admire the bronze horses atop the Basilica of St. Mark, but few know that those horses were robbed from Constantinople. Next, Constantinople faced the onslaught of the Ottoman Turks, a new force who swiftly conquered the Eastern Roman Empire's lands in the Near East, until eventually Constantinople was reduced essentially just to its city limits, a capital without its empire. In these crises, Constantinople could not really hope for help from the West, because doctrinal questions and theological disputes had separated the Western Latin Christians from the Eastern Orthodox Christians in the so-called Great Schism of 1054. The Ottoman Turks, for their part, were determined to capture this splendid city. Their nickname for it was the Golden Apple, the ultimate prize. Like New York, the Big Apple of our times, Constantinople, the Golden Apple, was seen at the time as the ultimate metropolis, the ultimate object of desire. Given all this, it was clear that eventually the city must fall. And the real wonder is how long it had held out, given its deeply weakened state.
This is the end of the listening paper.